On this episode of China Unscripted, we interview Professor Clive Hamilton about the split in the business community over how to deal with China, how whataboutism is used to distract from the Communist Party's abuses, and how the party's worldwide influence operations are going into overdrive. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshta.
Joining us today is Clive Hamilton, author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. He's also a professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University. And I hear he makes a killer Vegemite sandwich. Hi, Clive.
Hello there, Chris.
How are you doing?
I'm eating a Vegemite sandwich.
Did you make it yourself or did you buy it at a store?
Oh, you never buy it. You have to make it yourself.
Well, thank you for joining us all the way from Australia. I don't know which of us is upside down right now, but I'm sure it's very uncomfortable for one of us.
Thanks for gravity. We're all the right way up.
If you believe in the spherical globe lie.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep the flat earth jokes to a minimum in this podcast, unless you're into that kind of thing.
Listen, I worked for 10, 15 years on climate change, so I take conspiracies very seriously.
I see. You know, I never believed in global warming because it implies the earth is a globe.
Yeah, well, there are flat earthers who say they have members around the world.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
All around the globe.
All right.
I do believe in disc warming, though. It's a serious issue.
All right.
What is this podcast about, Chris?
Oh, hey. Clive, you wrote a really amazing book about China's influence operations in Australia. That was Silent Invasion. It came out in 2018. Since then, it seems the way people talk about China has changed dramatically. How do you think the situation has changed?
Well, it depends a bit on where you go. Certainly the global interest and alarm at the rise of China and its aggressive activities and subversive activities has shifted the global debate. I was talking to a senior official from Canada not long ago who said that whenever the G7 foreign ministers or prime ministers meet, the conversation is dominated by China. And 2 or 3 years ago, that simply wasn't the case. There are plenty of other things at the top of the agenda. And in the United States and especially Canada, there has been a real upsurge in the last 12 months in conversation about China. The whole debate has shifted. And that's a good thing, particularly in Canada. It's happened only in the last 6 months since Canada, at the request of the United States, arrested the Huawei executive, Meng Wanzhou. And suddenly Canadians started to realize that the People's Republic of China was not this cuddly panda that they'd imagined for decades, but really a quite brutal bullying state, and therefore the public opinion in Canada has shifted quite sharply in the way it has in Australia over the last 2 or 2.5 years. And so we've really entered into a completely new era in Western relationships with China. It's gloves off or game on, if you like. And it's very hard to know where things will go now, except that China, I think, will, first of all, experience an increasing pushback. And secondly, we in Western countries will experience a heightened, more intensive process of influence activities in our countries coming from Beijing.
Well, so what do you think has caused this disc-wide change about China?
I think it's differed from country to country. In Australia, it was a very prominent and worrying case of political interference when a Beijing-linked billionaire essentially co-opted an Australian senator and turned him into his puppet.
That was Wong Xiangmo, right?
Yes, Huang Chengmo and the Senator Sam Dastyari, which caused huge newspaper headlines and led to a bunch of stories about CCP influence in Australia. Mm-hmm. In Canada, it was the arrest of the Huawei executive I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. In the United States, it's been a bit different. There have been a trickle of stories bubbling along for the last two, three, 4 years, which really did not get much traction.
Including a YouTube channel that was talking about it since 2012 that also did not get much traction for many years.
And presumably that same YouTube channel has experienced a massive increase in its number of viewers in the last year or so as a result of the public shift in the United States. And I think what happened there was essentially a split in the business community around 2016 when the U.S. Chamber of Commerce put out a report essentially saying, if I can kind of paraphrase,
please,
we're sick of waiting for China to honor its promises to open up and treat American companies fairly on a level playing field. And we think it's time to abandon this idea that Beijing is going to liberalize in the way it's promised for decades. And we need to protect ourselves. We need to change our attitude. And I say it was a split in the business community because what that meant was that American manufacturers were splitting away from Wall Street, who have been gung-ho about China and opening up and not pushing back and so on. As one senior person in Washington said to me, people who love deals love China. And that's Wall Street. And I think that split in the business community gave permission for people who had been worried about China but felt constrained by the apparent business consensus that we must not do anything to anger Beijing. It gave those people permission to say, yeah, absolutely, and we need to start calling out the Communist Party and pushing back.
Well, that's kind of funny. You know, decades of human rights abuses, nah, that's fine. When it starts to hurt these businesses in their pocketbook, then it's an issue. Sorry, that's not funny. That's tragic.
Well, I think actually...
Truly it is. And I think your observation tells us something very powerful and deeply troubling about the modern world, how economic business considerations blind most people to profound violations of human rights. And I think that the astonishing mass incarceration of an ethnic group in Xinjiang in China over the last year or so would 4 or 5 years ago have been largely ignored. Whereas now there's much more permission for people to highlight those abuses. There's much more media and political attention being paid to those abuses. So organizations like Human Rights Watch, which have been talking about this for years and tearing their hair out, are now suddenly being invited to address Congress and comment in the media and so on.
In terms of the business community, it seems from the stories that have been coming out that actually a lot of businesses for many years were suffering at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party and just afraid to say anything. Do you think that's changed now?
Yeah, I think for many years, American businesses and others, of course, around the world were suffering in silence. They had the view that if we can gain some benefit in China, it might be to our cost in the short term, but in the long term, it's going to pay off. But increasingly, they found that those who were warning that they would have their technology stolen and they would be and their businesses taken over by essentially being forced into joint ventures with shadowy partners were not worth the promised access to this vast Chinese market. We also had many companies, including some of the biggest in the world, whose technology was being plundered through cyber hacking and so on, but who would say nothing. They were afraid to speak up. partly because they thought they would attract retribution from Beijing, but also because they did not want to damage their reputation by in the United States, for example, by saying, you know, we've had our crown jewels stolen, and we're now facing a competitor who has our technology for nothing. And so I think that's now changed. And the authorities, of course, have become far more assertive in chasing down technology thieves. FBI, for example, is putting enormous resources into trying to track and prosecute cyber hackers and other kinds of thieves stealing American technology. And so there's now a willingness, I think, on the part of U.S. businesses to collaborate with the authorities to try to stem this massive flow of technological IP offshore to China.
Now, you mentioned that people who love deals love China, and I don't know anyone who loves deals more than Donald Trump. But it seems like this administration has been, at least in my memory, which isn't that long, the most hawkish towards the Chinese Communist Party. What do you think about that?
It's a paradox, isn't it, that Donald Trump, the ultimate deal maker, the pragmatist par excellence, is the one that decided to muscle up to China and try to put a stop to the deception with trade rules, the tech theft, the international bullying, the subversion, and so on. Trump has waxed and waned on China, or did for a while. He had hawks and doves whispering in his ear, some of them in the White House, some of them his very good friends. And I think that over the months in the White House, two things happened. One is he realized that he was being shafted by Xi Jinping. He hates, you know, he loves a deal, but he hates losing deals. He hates losing negotiations. And I think he started to realize that they were putting it over him. But the other thing is that I think from a political point of view, he started to realize that he actually really believes this stuff about protecting the United States from the competition and threat posed by the People's Republic of China. And so, strange as it may seem, I think he actually believes in this. And so he's become more and more determined to be the president who stood up to China. And now in the last just days, we're starting to see commentators who are very close to this begin to talk about the next presidential election in, what is it, some 18, 20 months' time, in which Donald Trump, who now I think actually wants a second term, I think for a long time he didn't because he never expected to win and found being president too hard, but now I think he wants a second term. He wants to win, of course, and he sees his hawkish stand against China as being a decisive political advantage. And so one of the things he's doing is attacking the Democrats for being soft on China. And, of course, Joe Biden is the softest of the potential Democratic presidential rivals.
There was an interesting article in the Financial Times today that was about how Democrats have started to, you know, toughen their stance on China, possibly in response to all this stuff where Cory Booker was calling out the IP theft and saying that the Chinese, you know, government steals and we have to, you know, deal with that. And but it reminded me of this kind of happens, I think, every presidential election where people get hawkish on China, especially on the trade situation. And then after somebody gets into office, it kind of dies down.
Right. I mean, I remember during the last campaign, Hillary Clinton spoke several times about, you know, the Chinese hackers stealing our stuff. And I mean, of course, with any candidate, that was the assumption, that they would talk tough and then do nothing when they got into office, which was why it was such a surprise for me that, like, from day one, Donald Trump started to take China very seriously once he actually became president.
Even before then, I think it was back in 2012 or 13, he did that tweet about how global warming was a Chinese conspiracy.
I like how that kind of brought it all back together.
Yeah. He managed to get his two favorite topics into one statement. That's right. But I think that we need to look at the record of political candidates on China. And Trump had been talking about China for a long time, and it was very consistent with his Make America Great Again kind of we're sick of being pushed around position, which I'm not endorsing, incidentally, but in China it happens to be right. With Clinton, Hillary Clinton, she had a pretty long-standing position on being tough on China, and Beijing was very happy when she was replaced as Secretary of State with the very dovish John Kerry. And I think the debate in the United States has shifted so much that the Democrats who are speaking out are serious about it and are unlikely to backtrack at least too much if they were to win. I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been consistently talking tough about China. And, you know, I think they genuinely believe it and now see it as China as a strategic and economic threat to the United States, as well as one that has such an appalling record of human rights violations. I think some politicians at the backs of their minds are thinking about the 1930s and the appeasers who for years and years and years found excuses to for the rise of the Nazis in Germany, and at the end of the 30s were badly caught out and had a lot to be ashamed about. And, you know, I don't resile from that comparison. I mean, if you look at the way Xi Jinping's regime is behaving in China and increasingly aggressively abroad, the parallels with Nazi Germany become more and more alarming. So I think there is a genuine feeling in these elements of the Democrats that, you know, they want to align with Trump on this. And indeed, they have called out Trump on a couple of occasions where they feel that he's backtracked. And you would have seen Chuck Schumer issue the a tweet a few days ago in response to Trump's announcement that he was going to up the tariffs, saying, you know, go President Trump, don't backtrack on this. So I think the Democrats, perhaps with the exception of, in fact, with the exception of Joe Biden, really locking in behind Trump on this and making it very difficult for them to backtrack, particularly as United States society and institutions have shifted so markedly, other than Wall Street.
I mean, China really brings us all together.
Yeah, thanks, Xi Jinping.
Well, I actually do have a question about that, because when the tariffs kind of came through, then I think we saw a lot of, and maybe this is kind of the Wall Street analysis that you were talking about, where there was a lot of hand-wringing over how the tariffs are ultimately bad for the U.S. and this is just, you know, Trump being stupid again and this kind of thing. And also, and there's still, I think, a pretty sizable number of people who are saying, you know, there's nothing to worry about with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, let's not get into like a red scare. I mean, do you think that's still something that's kind of happening in the discussion about all of this stuff?
Yes, sure. I think that's interesting. There's a kind of curious alignment here between Wall Street and the liberal left. We've seen that to a degree in Australia too. And if you doubt it, Each time the New York Times publishes a story about some aggressive action by Beijing or some profoundly unfair tech theft program or something like that, If you then go to the comment section below the story, you'll see an outpouring from the Liberal left. And hey, I put up my hand. I'm a paid up member. I carry a party card for the Liberal left until the scales fell from my eyes on China. But you'll see a whole string of comments which are really excoriating the United States, saying, you know, whatever China may have done, United States, you know, done it, but much worse. You know, look at Trump doing A, B, C, and D. This is all just driven by anti-Chinese sentiment, et cetera, et cetera. We've seen a lot of that in Australia. It's a standard trope now, coming from everyone from the, you know, Beijing's embassy, not far from where I am, to the far left, plus the co-opted portions of the Labor Party, saying this is all just driven by Sinophobia. That's a very powerful political sentiment, and is certainly part of the pushback and resistance against facing up to this problem. So you're right, we should not underestimate the power of that. But I do think that there are now so many forces, including some progressive forces, that recognize that this is a serious threat, that Beijing is a serial human rights violator, the likes of which we haven't seen for a long time. And we just have to change our view that it's no longer the cuddly panda, but the fire-breathing dragon.
I have a funny kind of whataboutism, like that you were talking about with the, you know, America's done it so much worse, that kind of rhetoric. My sister was talking to somebody last night about the Belt and the Road, and they seem to understand kind of like the debt trap worries that and the things that the Chinese government were doing that were, you know, pretty scary in a lot of ways in these other countries. And then they said, you know, but America does the same thing too. I mean, there are McDonald's and other every country in the world.
It's astonishing, isn't it? That guy over there killed somebody, so it doesn't matter so much that this guy here killed somebody. I mean, the logic of it is quite bizarre. I mean, you can be a serious critic of US imperialism, you know, which, yeah, if we think back to the 60s, 70s in Latin America, and still some intervention now. You know, you can be with Noam Chomsky on that, but how does that change our clear analysis of the nature of the Chinese Communist Party regime, what it's doing internally and what it's doing externally? Yeah, the whataboutism is a kind of curious psychological coping strategy, a way of not facing up to a significant threat, I think. But it's also, I think that, you know, deep beneath it, there's how dare you try to distract attention from this evil beast that I've been talking about for many, many years, the United States, by talking about another evil beast. You somehow kind of diminish, you know, the bogeyman that I've built up. But then, of course, there isn't a moral equivalent. No matter what you say about the United States, and you can say a lot, it has been and continues to be a democratic liberal society. I mean, the point is that whenever you, that the critics, there have been no harsher critics of US actions abroad than Americans at home, where you have a free press, where you have a free academy, where you have an active civil society, where you have human rights activists out there on the streets constantly. You don't have any of that in China. And so it's far more threatening, far more dangerous, because it has no opposition at home.
So when you're talking about China, do you ever have somebody come up to you and say, you know, you say all these things about China, but what about all the bad things Australia has done?
Oh, yeah. someone actually said the other day in public, someone from abroad it was in Australia, and somebody brought up the question of a million Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and she said, oh yeah, but you Australians incarcerate boat people on Manus Island. I mean, there are 200 people on Manus Island, appalling conditions, although they do get all kinds of access to medical care and they're properly fed and so on, but they are nevertheless incarcerated. And it just struck me that here is this person saying, don't tell me about a million Uyghurs incarcerated in Xinjiang who have to cut off their hair, renounce their religious beliefs and chant Communist Party slogans. Look what you guys are doing on Manus Island. I was just gobsmacked. I thought, well, yep, what's happening on Manus Island is not good. And people like me have been, Australians have been, you know, criticizing and campaigning for a change. But how can you possibly say, downplay, dismiss, turn your face away from this massive crime against humanity in Xinjiang by pointing to Manus Island? I mean, it's a bizarre thing to do.
Well, you know, you've talked a lot about sort of the progress that is being made with recognizing the Chinese Communist Party as a threat globally or disc-wide. But you also have cases of, like recently, Italy, a G7 country, joined the Belt and Road. You have New Zealand seemingly doing the same thing.
I mean, I know that you, as an Australian, you probably want to, you know, talk down to New Zealanders, so I'd love to hear your take on that.
Oh, no. Brothers and sisters across the ditch, as we call them. I mean, New Zealand has a serious problem, as a handful of China experts recognize. It's been so captured by CCP influence, Chinese business. The political class has been almost drugged by the China potion, and so can't evaluate properly, despite warnings from the security services and a handful of China experts about what's happening. Italy is a really interesting case because the right-wing populist government there has been heavily influenced by a couple of individuals, some of whom have very deep China ties. There's a junior minister for economics and industry there, name of Gerassi, who's been an academic at Ningbo in China for many years and has clearly become very much a CCP apologist. And he's been highly influential in persuading the Prime Minister of Italy to become friendly with Beijing. And of course, Beijing could see the opportunity some years ago in the EU when Germany and in particular, backed by the UK and France, were imposing heavy conditions on Italy and Greece because of the debt they got into. And China came in and started exploiting the resentment that generated and offering an alternative source of investment and international friendship. And so that was very attractive to the government of Greece and now the government of Italy. And so it's been a very clever strategy by Beijing of divide and conquer, which is what it's famous for. And it's very worrying that the G7 has been split in this way, that Italy is now signing up to the Belt and Road Agreement and opening the doors to investment from China in a way that will, through the purchase of ports and infrastructure and so on, begin to pose a strategic threat to the rest of Europe, just as China's influence in Central and Eastern Europe is, in a way, surrounding the European Union. I mean, there is a specific CCP strategy which is practiced here as elsewhere called something like surround the center by taking over the periphery. That's what they're doing in Europe. That's what they do within countries in Australia, for example, they've gone out to the Australian state capitals where they're enhancing their influence. And so we can track it very clearly, and it works very, very well.
It's kind of like a Sun Tzu Art of War strategy.
Exactly. Anything to avoid violent confrontation with the main power, you do everything else you can to weaken it, taking away its allies, surrounding it, carrying out subversion to weaken its will, and so on.
On Silent Invasion, it's like a handbook of all the tactics the Communist Party has used around the world. Now that so many of these tactics have been exposed, have you seen the Chinese Communist Party changing tactics, trying something new?
That's a really good question, and I've been watching for this, particularly in my country, but also in a couple of others, notably Canada, where there's a large diaspora and a sharp change in the public debate. I think there's a bit more caution and secrecy about it. I think some agents of Beijing in countries like Australia were becoming careless in their statements and their links that could be tracked on Chinese language websites. I think they're being told to be more careful. Certain people exposed for their executive positions in United Front organizations are now resigning from them and quietly on the surface distancing themselves from them. But otherwise, the manual of tactics is there. It's detailed, it's extensive, it's effective. I think that the same tactics are being implemented now with a bit more secrecy, with a bit more caution, but also with more resources being poured into them. And so we haven't seen any pullback, not in the least. We're probably seeing a ramping up of the tactics, of the resources going into them. United Front Work Department, for example, huge resources into it, the propaganda strategy abroad, more and more resources being put into it. So I think although there's more understanding of the tactics, much more study of the handbook, if you like, or the handbooks, the CCP has such a broad range of tactics that it's going to take a long time and a variety of strategies to begin to counter them effectively.
So why are they ramping up, do you think?
Well, they were always going to ramp up particularly under Xi Jinping, ramp up the investment in foreign influence and foreign interference activities. Nothing has really changed. Certainly the pushback and hostility from other countries has not reached a level to make them rethink the entire going out strategy. So it's just a question of tweaking it here and there in order to continue the campaign to extend influence, extend interference, and extend domination over other parts of the world.
You mentioned the ways to kind of counteract that. What would those be?
The first and most important way of responding to Beijing's influence and interference activities is to shed sunlight on it. It makes it more difficult for them if the shadows they were operating in are no longer shadows. They have to retreat into deeper shadows. So the news media and public discussion are exceptionally important in this. That's the first thing.
Right. I mean, and you know that because they always ask people to talk about human rights issues behind closed doors.
They're constantly doing that. Beijing really hates public discussion, and they hate other nations coming together to expose human rights abuses and so on. And so they very effectively persuade nations to engage in one-on-one diplomacy and to keep it behind closed doors. But also there are a series of legislative measures that have been introduced. There's a new one I noticed that yesterday was introduced to the US House of Representatives, I think, which is a bill that would ban any Chinese scientist studying or being employed in American laboratories if he or she has an association with a PLA, a Chinese military university or research institution. And that came about as a result of the work of the researcher Alex Joski, who exposed that hundreds of PLA scientists have been studying and doing research, often in military-related activities, at Western universities. An astonishing fact. Now we see the US introducing a measure to prevent that. So I think we're only at the beginning of the legislative pushback, and of course that has to be matched with resources to enforce the legislation and a whole range of other administrative measures. I noticed, for instance, that the FBI has a fairly substantial program of outreach in the United States, going and talking to business associations, big businesses, universities, university presidents, talking to them about the nature of the threat that is posed by the PRC, the infiltration, the technology theft, and so on. And so I think that's crucial, an awareness raising. And the FBI, I understand, is having mixed results. Something similar, but on a lower level, is happening in Australia. But I think the authorities here are facing quite a lot more pushback. University administrators, for example, are really, living in cloud cuckoo land. They still believe that, all collaboration is good, and what are you talking about? This is just Sinophobia, isn't it? So we have a long, long way to go, but at least the pushback has started.
Cloud cuckoo land, can I use that?
You can use cloud cuckoo land, but it's cloud cuckoo land, not cloud cuckoo land.
Can you say that one more time? I didn't quite catch the difference. This is the important question.
Cloud cuckoo land. Our university administrators are living in cloud cuckoo land, where it's an imaginary world where everyone is nice and friendly and no one would ever rip you off.
Sounds nice. It's the opposite of the internet. So, Clive, I'm curious, after Silent Invasion came out, how has your life changed? Like, I imagine it created big waves in how you were living your life.
You bet. I had no idea when I started this process, actually, where I'd end up two or three years later. Let me see, it's only 2 years. Wow. I spend all day, every day, thinking about China and the Chinese Communist Party. And that's
welcome to our world.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant thing to meditate on, It's pretty unsettling. There's a constant state of a sense that there's this very major threat to the state of the world, which we know and love, like free speech, that has to be responded to, and it's going to go on for decades. It's not a pleasant thing to be immersed in, but there it is. That's what we do. And of course, there are issues of, personal security and cyber security that are constantly on the mind of people who get engaged in this. And that's not a pleasant thing to have to think about as well, because, Beijing is ruthless. It has its agents everywhere. The cohort of people in the media and in academia and so on who decide to invest themselves in this have to be aware that there are some pretty hostile people out there who want to shut you up.
It's definitely not cloud cuckoo land. Did I get it right that time?
Yeah, cloud cuckoo land definitely has its attractions.
So, Clive, I understand you're writing a new book right now.
Yeah, my publisher proposed to me that I write another book, which is a kind of global version of Silent Invasion. And I thought about it for a while and thought, yeah, why not? No one else seems to be writing it. So I've teamed up with a German colleague, a sinologist, and we're in the thick of writing that book. It's got, when I say global, it's actually impossible. It'd be 12 volumes if it were global. But
Well, it'd also be impossible because the Earth is flat.
Well, we're focusing heavily on North America and on Europe. Who knows when we'll be able to stop. But, yeah, it grows and grows. But, yeah, we hope that book will be out next year.
Well, it'll get censored by the publisher, and then you have to find a new publisher, right?
Yeah, well, we've got publishers who are aware of that. And it's getting picked up in foreign languages as well. So we expect it might face some obstacles. But, it'll be out.
I mean, I've heard that even books that are published by a Western company but physically printed in China now face issues because the printing companies in China won't print,
yeah,
these things.
Yeah, in fact, it was I who sent out to the world via Twitter the lists of banned names of CCP leaders, of dissidents, of incidents in China's history that cannot be mentioned in any book that is printed in China. And most American, Australian publishers print many or most of their books in China because they have an excellent printing industry. They've invested in the best technology and they can do it some 30% cheaper, even more if their books are in color than anywhere else. And now they're saying that if you talk about the Dalai Lama the Tiananmen Square massacre in a book, even though it's in English and not intended for the Chinese market, we will not print it in China. Well, the printers are saying that we'll get in too much trouble, so don't try it. And that means that imposes an increased cost on commercial publishers. So it's just one more point of leverage that the Chinese Communist Party has over free speech in United States and Australia.
Yeah, it's very much like the Hollywood issue, where Hollywood doesn't want to make movies now that don't that aren't going to make money in the China market, and so they just restrict what they produce as a result of that.
It's a massive problem. You know, people like me have been saying, well, look, Beijing or China under the CCP has very little soft power. I mean, you know, how many movies do they produce that make people like me want to go and live in China?
Wolf Warrior 2.
Warrior 2. But I realize on the Hollywood issue that whilst Beijing may not be able to generate soft power throughout the rest of the world to enhance the image of China under the CCP, what it has done is effectively closed down in a decisive way America's most effective and famous form of soft power, and that is Hollywood. And so it's manipulating U.S. soft power in a way that benefits Beijing.
I think we all need just like a moment to take a deep sigh.
Yeah. And go and have a cup of coffee.
Or a Vegemite sandwich.
The two don't go together.
Does anything go with that?
Our Vegemite sandwiches are fantastic. Yeah, a cup of tea, lemonade, you name it. Australian kids are brought up on Vegemite sandwiches. You have to remember that.
It's an acquired taste. Because I used to live in Australia, and it was, when I first tried it, it was horrible. I mean, I can't express to you how disgusting it was. But yeah, over the course of a few months, you know, I gradually acquired a taste for it. I've now lost that taste. I'm no longer interested at all. But
it is an acquired taste. But, you know, if your first solid food is a triangle of Vegemite sandwich with the crust cut off, there's no going back.
Well, Clive, I think the next time we're in Australia, we might have to take you up on a Vegemite sandwich.
I'm good at making them, so I'd be happy to oblige.
Great, Clive. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the new book and everything else you're doing. If somebody wants to learn more about you or what you're doing, obviously everyone listening should get Silent Invasion. That's a fantastic book. But where else can they learn about you and what you're doing?
Oh, I post some of my articles, shorter pieces on China and other matters on my website, clivehamilton.com. You'll find me there.
Great. Well, yes, thank you again for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
A great pleasure. More power to you guys.
Wow, I really feel that Clive understands what it's like to spend all your time thinking about China. A kindred spirit. Are you guys just all sad?
You know, it was a little bit depressing. I don't know if a Vegemite sandwich would make me feel better or worse right now.
Even with the crusts cut off, Shelley?
Yeah, for me, a Vegemite sandwich just won't do it. I need two Vegemite sandwiches.
I mean, I could go for some stinky tofu right now.
Oh, hey, I guess that's like the Chinese equivalent of Vegemite.
It is, kind of, isn't it?
I always think of stinky tofu as a Taiwanese thing.
Are you saying Taiwan is not part of China?
I'm saying that Taiwan is not part of China.
Shelley!
I'm so controversial. Oh, no.
We are not going to publish a transcript of this conversation in a publisher that's printing their books in China. That's,
actually, I did see
what you just said.
I did see the list that Clive had tweeted, and it basically is like a very concise list of all of the Chinese Communist Party's like really deep-seated insecurities.
I guess that was the problem with the song on the CBS show Good Fight. It was just a list of all the things the party doesn't want talked about.
Yeah,
so I got censored.
Yeah, there you go.
I like describing it as the Communist Party's insecurities.
I mean, like,
because it makes me think about how I don't like other people talking about my insecurities.
Well, this is why they're always talking about hurting the feelings of the Chinese people.
That's true. Yeah,
we really mean hurting the feelings of the Chinese Communist Party, though.
Well, they have feelings too, Shelley.
The party has feelings.
The party itself has feelings.
So maybe we should just criticize them behind closed doors.
Anyway.
Great transition.
I'm tired. It's late. Obviously, we talked to a man in Australia, so we have to be either very early or very late.
That's true.
And so, thank you for listening to the China Unscripted podcast. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
Thanks for listening.